You know, you can be really healthy, but if you haven't trained for a race, you're potentially going to be more problems than somebody who's unhealthy but has put the time and effort into training appropriately.
Hello and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Marcus Stevens, and today we're joined by Dr. Amy Bolsch. Welcome to the podcast, Amy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Amy is a GP trainee based in Bath with a long-standing interest in sports and exercise medicine. She is also an incredibly talented long-distance runner, winning last year's Buckcombe 50 Ultra, a 50-mile race through the Mendip Hills in Somerset. Amy is also a running coach and has recently completed her Master's in Sports and Exercise Medicine. She has volunteered as a medic at multiple UK marathons and is currently the project lead for a new app, Race Ready, which is being launched to improve the health, safety, and performance of runners as they prepare for races and events. She also sits on the London Marathon Medicine Conference Committee, which aims to bring the latest running research to runners and clinicians ahead of the London Marathon each year. Amy is a particularly intimidating guest to interview as she has hosted her own podcast for the last 3 years, which I've been enjoying very much over the last few weeks, and hopefully picking up some hosting tips. So today we're going to be talking all about running medicine. So Amy, would you be able to tell the listeners a bit about how you've incorporated both of these passions over the last few years?
Yeah, of course. It was something that happened relatively late in terms of my medical career, I suppose. I was one of those people that bumbled around medical school, changing their mind quite frequently about what I wanted to do, and certainly hadn't even thought that sports medicine was a possibility. But it was on my elective, so right at the very end of medical school, that I was training for the London Marathon. And I was actually on a dermatology elective and had almost no interest in the dermatology I was seeing and learning about, but a huge amount of interest in how I could perform better and the science about training. And that was what I was spending my time doing. So it was through that that I kind of thought, well, if this is what my interest is and we have to put so much extra work into medicine to get to these specialties that we ultimately end up in, why not try and make it something that I'm really interested about? So it all started from there. So it's been the last kind of 5 years or so, just going to various conferences, meeting people in the field, obviously doing my master's as you mentioned, and really trying to incorporate the thing that I love most in my spare time and trying to make that relevant to my job as much as possible.
And have you been running your whole life as well, or is that a more recent sporting endeavour?
I was definitely dragged out as a child, but I'm not sure I would say I enjoyed it then. It was more once I was at university, definitely a stress release for me, something that felt, when everything else felt uncontrollable at university, it's definitely something that felt more controllable to me, and a really good way of meeting people as well. So I've definitely found moving around, and we do that a lot as medics get sent to various hospitals and locations. I've definitely found that's the way I've made most of my friends, to be honest. Running clubs tend to have a big social element to them as well. And I think just it kind of ticked every box. It kept me fit, it kept me healthy, it was good for stress and also just good for meeting people and making new places feel like home quite quickly. So I'd say more competitively in the last few years. But I guess it's always been kind of sprinkled through life from an early age.
I know the feeling. I think a lot of people will empathise with that as well. And you're a GP trainee here in Bath now. So I'm a couple of years ahead now, having gone through the programme and now locuming in the area. Where were you working before? Where did you study? And why did you decide on coming here to Bath? And why GP?
So I studied at King's in London. So I was based in London Bridge and then did my foundation training there as well. So I didn't go too far. I did my F1 in Woolwich and F2 in St. Thomas's, which was a really great experience. But I think by that point I'd been in London for 8 years and I was done, as most people get to that stage eventually. So I had a great time, but I just needed something that felt a bit more homely, maybe a bit more, a slightly slower pace. And that's not to say that Bath is necessarily a slower pace at work, but it's definitely a smaller, friendlier hospital vibe, as I'm sure you've experienced. So I made that move and I came back here because I grew up here actually. So it wasn't too drastic of a change. My family's still close by. And it's a hard place to leave. I didn't think I'd necessarily move back to being close to my parents, but actually Bath's beautiful. I feel very lucky to live here. And I've definitely enjoyed doing my GP training here. You get a lot of good support, I found, and people in the hospital know you. It's a friendly place to work. So I've been really happy here.
Yeah, definitely. I'm very, very happy here myself. And we're going to touch particularly on race medicine, which I have to say, researching this podcast and reading about some of the work you've done before wasn't something, a particular term I was all that familiar with. Clearly, you know, the sports and exercise medicine is a specialty, something I've come across and certainly been interested in. But what is race medicine? What does it encompass? And what kind of conditions are you seeing?
Yeah, that just reminded me that I didn't actually answer your question about why I chose GP, which maybe feeds into this answer. So race medicine is looking at the injuries and illnesses that occur during training and during the events of endurance road running and trail running races. I'm not sure it's really a specialty in itself, maybe a small subspecialty of sports medicine. And I think my interest in it is mainly because it's so personal to me, because I enjoy running races, so have a vested interest in keeping myself safe and healthy whilst I'm doing them. And I guess GP training felt like a natural route for me to take, because race medicine isn't really a specialty by itself. You can't really be a full-time race medicine doctor, but being a GP trainee and ultimately a GP does give you a lot of flexibility, which I think attracts a lot of people into the specialty, so that you can do your GP work during the week. But then at the weekends, when there are these big races, you can go there, and often it is volunteering your time, but actually it's a really nice way to complement your GP work, which is very individual and you're working alone a lot of the time, often just you and the patient. Whereas in race medicine, it's very team-based. So I've always worked with other people at these events. You get the buzz of being at a race without necessarily the stress of having to run that day, and just get to be involved in the sport that you love. And the things that you see really vary. And I guess that depends what race you're at and where in the race you are. So for example, this year I volunteered at both Brighton and London Marathons. So that was in April of this year. And London Marathon, I was at mile 11. And Brighton Marathon, I was at the very end. And you can imagine that things affect people very differently at mile 11 compared to mile 26. So at mile 11, it was very large numbers of people. I saw so many people, but it was all very quick fixes. So a lot of blisters, aches and pains, people needing paracetamol, bleeding nipples, all of those kind of very easy things that we can help with and hopefully get people on their way and finishing the race. And then Brighton was just a completely different experience, because I was at the finish line. So that's when, I mean, you still see those minor ailments, but typically it's the more serious things that come into that final tent. So you definitely don't see the amount of people that you would see earlier on in the race, but you're spending a lot more time with them because they can be quite sick. So a lot of collapses for various reasons. So whether that's heat stroke, hyponatremia, low sodium, and all manner of things really. But that's where things maybe are a bit more stressful at the end, where people can really push themselves that final mile and things can unfortunately sometimes go wrong, but that's why we're there.
Goodness, yeah. I suspect if you've got to mile 11 of a marathon and you're struggling with blisters, perhaps your preparation wasn't quite as tip-top as it could have been, but maybe we'll touch on that later. And does the distance, or how does the distance of races, and, you know, the last few years we've seen, you know, massive proliferation of ultramarathons and more extreme events, how does that play into the different pattern of pathology you're seeing during a race?
Yeah, I think obviously that the clue's in the name with the ultra events is that people are on their feet for a lot longer. So maybe the difference between marathons and ultra marathons isn't huge compared to, say, half marathons, where people tend to only be out for maybe 2 hours. But when you're getting to these longer events, so marathons and ultra marathons, I think there's part of it is just exposure to the environment. So, you know, people are out in the heat for a long time, they're out in the sun for a long time. They're possibly out in the wind and the rain for a long time. So you're more likely to see things like heat-related illness or hypothermia, depending on what the conditions are. and how well people have prepared and taken the kit that they're recommended to take. And then I think there's been a lot of issues with hyponatremia is probably a big one, which is when people's sodium levels drop, and the longer they're out there, the more likely that is to occur, especially if they're not taking on salts effectively. So I'd say the longer the race, I think that becomes more and more prominent. And they've done studies that have shown almost like 50% of people that cross the finish line of an ultra marathon will have low sodium levels, but it affects people very differently. So obviously not everyone that's got low sodium is becoming unwell and collapsing. We're obviously able to tolerate it to different extents, but I think that's a really big issue. And I imagine as races become longer and they're increasing in popularity and people with different health conditions take part, I imagine that will become more of an issue over time. But I don't have the numbers about how many of those actually end up being seriously unwell, but the numbers that have a measured sodium, that's what we would think as a medic is really quite low. It's actually about 50% when you just do random samples. But obviously these people just recover themselves and never have to see one of us, luckily.
Having ran my first and I hope only ever 50 kilometre run this summer in France, I was thinking at various times, I dread to think what my bloods would look like if I took them right now, or quite how high my core belly temperature was. So that put me off a little while.
There's quite a lot of interesting... Sorry, there's quite a lot of interesting research at Brighton where they've had people swallow temperature probe pills and monitor their temperature over a race. And it's really similar. You get this proportion of people that are what we would consider to be hypothermic with really high body temperatures. But obviously they continue running, finish the race with no effects. But we only know that they've been that hot because of these pills that they've swallowed as part of research. And they've done similar things with troponin. So troponins go through the roof for a lot of runners, but obviously they have no ill effects. And I think this is all early stages of research to think about whether actually is this having some silent effect that we don't know about yet. But it's really interesting to think how many abnormalities occur in the bloods and whether that's important or not, because these people aren't being affected, whereas other people are.
Well, I'm very pleased I didn't know about the troponin thing while I was plodding around Lake Annecy this summer. That would have taken anxiety to a whole other level. Mentioning that, I have, over the years, seen a few patients in A&E or in GP who have been, you know, very good athletes or very predominantly very good ultra athletes, you know, Ironmans, multiple Ironmans or you know, very long distance running races. And it's not something I've read much up on, but I'm aware that there is supposedly a cutoff of kind of exercise per day or, you know, volume of exercise above which there are sort of deleterious consequences. Is that true? And kind of where is that line and how do we avoid that?
Yes, they talk about a J-shaped curve where those that are inactive, they'll get the greatest benefits from being just slightly active. So right at the end of that curve, you'll see the biggest effects. And then there's this middle category where everything's in a nice balance. So the more activity you do, the better your immune system is, the better your mental and physical health. But then there is this small category of people that exercise to such a high level, and we know that can really impact the immune system. So those athletes are actually more prone to getting infections, particularly upper respiratory tract infections. And we also know that there's a slight increased risk of arrhythmias later down the line. So things like AF and calcification of the arteries. But as far as I'm aware, that isn't associated with mortality. So although they have these findings, they're more likely to have AF, particularly it's middle-aged male runners are more likely to have AF if they train quite hard. It's not associated with the same mortality as someone in the general population with AF. So I think it is true there's definitely an optimum level of physical activity to do. But I think for the vast majority of people, the chances of going over the top is really slim. I can't remember the exact numbers of hours that you have to be doing each week, but it's high. Most people won't be hitting that. These are the really elite athletes. And I guess once you're in that situation, you've got people around you that are keeping you healthy anyway. It's their jobs to keep you healthy if you're that elite. So yes, I think I think there is a risk that you can overdo it, but I think for the majority of people, it's going to offer way more benefits than risks. And it might just be that, say, at the peak marathon training, you may be slightly more at risk of things like coughs and colds than your friends who aren't training for a marathon. But in terms of serious impacts on health, I think you have to be training really quite a lot for that to happen.
That's good to know. I'm nowhere near that. Excellent. So you've touched a little bit on race medicine and what you've been seeing at various events over the last year. Where do you see the kind of future of race medicine? You mentioned you're working on an app, and you know, where do you see the next few years or perhaps the next decade of the race medicine world?
Interesting question. We'll see, I guess. The Race Medicine app, so this is an app called Race Ready that I have been working on with some medical directors of some of the UK marathons. And this is designed to bring evidence-based medical and training advice to the runner. So I think in a really positive way, people are signing up to a lot more races. We're seeing a really wide range of demographics signing up to some really tough events, which is great to see from a physical health perspective and also kind of the social elements and mental health as well. But there are, in some cases, risks associated with that. And I think a lot of these races don't necessarily always provide the most thorough medical advice or the most evidence-based. And also it can be a bit confusing because you sign up to one race and it says this, and then you sign up to another race and it says that. And for the runner who doesn't necessarily know anything about how to keep safe during a race, that can be really confusing and probably is the last thing on their list when they're training. They want to know that they can do the miles. They're not so worried about all the bad things that can happen about them, which is completely understandable. So the Race Ready app is designed to be really user-friendly for runners to work their way through various medical problems that they can encounter, right from kind of the simple stuff like blisters that we mentioned to the really serious problems like collapse. And it basically gives information about how to avoid these, what happens if they do sadly occur, and kind of returning to exercise after that. And it's designed in levels so that people can work through. If they just want to take the key takeaways, they can just read level one for all of these topics. If they want to really delve into the science behind all of these things, we have level two and three, which provides more information. And the hope is that it provides a kind of unified source of really up-to-date information from key players in race medicine so that runners can just access this ahead of their race rather than have to search for the information themselves. So I think I'm hoping that really advances race medicine, because you'll get people turning up to races that are more informed and able to look after themselves, which I do think is important. As these races become longer and more challenging, often that means you're running in more difficult terrain with less support. And there's only so much help that you're going to have access to during those types of events. So having this type of information source for runners, I think it is really important that I think we have a duty to provide kind of good advice to runners when they're signing up to these things, because it's not their job to know how to keep themselves safe. But if they've got something there that they can access, I hope that makes races safer in the future. And obviously we've got more research to do. So the things that I mentioned about the troponins and AKIs and all these various things that can potentially happen to a runner's body during a race, I think there's lots more to learn there, which is all quite exciting and hopefully will help us keep bringing more evidence-based advice to runners and race directors as well.
Sounds like a fantastic resource, and very keen to have a look at that when it's coming out. When are you expecting it to be released?
Yeah, this is the biggest stress in my life right now. We've been working on it for a year pretty much, and it's due to come out hopefully spring 2024, which is in line with the UK marathon season taking off. So I'll have a busy Christmas continuing to write everything for that app, but it's all coming together, and we've got our website now, which people can access, which is raceready.run, and that provides a sign up sheet, so you can get an email when the app comes out. Fingers crossed, in the spring this will be on everyone's phones.
Great, I look forward to getting on the app store then. So many of our listeners will be very keen runners themselves and very active. the wider GP and doctor population may well come across these events more so in their day job when patients come with a form, however long, asking them to sign them as fit to run. And I know it does cause some sort of consternation and concern amongst some of my colleagues. I'd just be really keen to get your sort of thoughts on, are these evidence-based? Is there an evidence that actually they do prevent people having potentially serious or fatal incidents during a race? Or is it all a kind of a slightly weak sort of legal mechanism to hope that someone doesn't sue when they trip off a mountain somewhere in the Lake District?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think it's the latter. It definitely tends to be something that's more common with the European races rather than the UK races. I've certainly not seen any UK races that require that. From a GP perspective, so, I mean, this is my area of interest, and I still wouldn't sign those forms. And I know that's really frustrating for patients, but actually that's firstly, it's a private thing. That's not NHS. It's not the NHS's job to be just deeming if someone's safe to run a race. And I hate to say that, because that is my area of interest, but it's just unfortunately the truth. And we're not really qualified to say that. How can we possibly, without doing extensive tests, it's really, really difficult to say if somebody is safe to take part in a race, especially when we're not coaches. We don't know how much they've trained. I'd feel more able to say if someone was going to be safe during an event if I was their running coach, which I know doesn't quite fit with what these forms are about. But, you know, you can be really healthy, but if you haven't trained for a race, you're potentially going to be more problems than somebody who's unhealthy but has put the time and effort into training appropriately. And we don't tend to screen for medical conditions before races in the UK. So a lot of countries will do things like ECGs, and I think they're appropriate for some people. For example, if there's a family history of sudden cardiac death, absolutely someone needs to have screening, but that's different to just signing a piece of paper that is having proper screening via their GP. I do think the GP's role is to kind of do some basic health screening. So for example, if someone has hypothyroidism, yes, we should be doing their thyroid blood test before a race. We should be giving them advice on medicines to stop or to hold just during their race period. We should be giving them some brief advice if they've got any problems to follow up with us afterwards. For example, if they've had a heat-related illness, they actually need a lot of support and advice to get back to exercise. So I think it's within our remit to just provide advice and guide people, but I definitely wouldn't feel comfortable myself just signing off to say somebody was fit and healthy to race and I'm going to take responsibility for that in a 10-minute consult when we don't really have any other information. I don't know if you've come across that and if you have different opinions, but that's definitely my thought process, and I don't think we're indemnified to do that either.
Yep, I'm glad you're in agreement there. I think perhaps some of the older generation of GPs seem slightly happier too, but for me it's always unfortunately something that doesn't fall within our remit. And some of the applications are, my brother, who's a very good runner, wanted to do a series of races in France, and he had to provide his scrambling and sort of mountain history and, you know, to confirm that he was safe to go on these sort of pretty big exposure ridges and things. So quite in-depth forms, really.
I don't want anyone handing me that form to sign.
Exactly. You mentioned coaching, and as I touched on before, you're a running coach. What does this involve, and how long have you been doing it, and are you able to bring your medical expertise into that role, and tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I've been coaching for a few years now, and I have to say I really, really enjoy it. It allows you to have the one-to-one relationship with somebody over a period of time that we tend not to get anymore in medicine, which is really nice. And you get to see the positive changes that somebody makes, the achievements that they have. And again, that's something that I think sadly has been lost a little bit with our job roles, and we kind of see different patients all the time and don't always get that continuity. Run coaching tends to be a one-to-one coaching relationship where someone might either come to me and say, oh, I haven't ever ran before and I want to start. Can you help me? Or I'm really struggling to commit to my training. Can you just provide some support and accountability for me? Or it's somebody that says, you know, I want to do my sub 3 marathon. Can you get me there? So it's really variable. I have to say I tend to feel most satisfied with the people that are just beginning or just want some accountability, because there's something nice about seeing somebody achieve their goal rather than necessarily a time goal. But in terms of bringing medical knowledge into it, it's one of those tricky areas where you have to actually be quite boundaried, because coaching is very different to medical advice, and I can't be someone's one-on-one doctor. I'd get into quite a bit of trouble. But I definitely think having that background in race medicine and my master's, I'm definitely able to give people better advice, I think, in terms of preparing for races and keeping safe, and knowing when people should go and see their own doctor or their own physio if things are going wrong. So I suppose that's definitely helpful, and understanding the science behind training is again really, really helpful. But actually, I think it almost works better the other way. So I think coaching really helps me with my medical practice, because a lot of what we do need to do in general practice is things like motivational interviewing and providing that accountability for people to look after their health. So I think there's a lot of overlap from that perspective as well.
Yeah, interesting. I think I find myself as a GP having that conversation, or trying to have the conversation so many times a day and trying to encompass in maybe a few minutes, you know, sort of no more than 10 minutes, how to sort of drastically change their exercise and sort of activity habits. And often walking away thinking, I wish I had a study in the background running that would tell me in a year or 2 years time how many of those patients it's worked on and if anyone has changed things. Any particular advice for those of us, you know, with patients who are, you know, like I mentioned, struggling to get more active, you know, certainly don't have a marathon time goal, you know, a few sort of quick tips in a short period of time to get across the key points, or try and sort of help support them on that early part of their sort of exercise activity journey?
Yeah, it's really tricky, and we're all under the time pressure. I think one thing that's reassuring as health professionals is, I don't know if you've heard this statistic, but the number needed to treat for physical activity is 12. So if you mention it to 12 patients, you mentioned your little study there, the evidence suggests that one person will end up meeting the physical activity guidelines. Whereas for smoking, which I feel like is drilled into us far, far more during our training, the number needed to treat is about 50. So you have to put a lot more work into getting somebody to stop smoking. And there's a concept in public health called making every contact count. And actually just mentioning physical activity or exercise or movement really does add up. And if enough people mention it to a patient, you know, the cogs will change in their brain. And hopefully at some point they'll feel like, you know, actually my doctor really does want me to do this. Maybe this is something I should try to start incorporating into my life. That being said, it is really hard to break habits. And if someone, you know, we all have bad habits. If someone told me to stop eating all the sweet treats that I eat to fuel my running, I'd really struggle. I think I just try and encourage small changes. So really get an understanding of somebody's life from kind of the moment they wake up in the morning to the moment they go to bed. And where can they maybe just make a small change to increase activity, and trying to focus on activity and movement rather than exercise and gym and running. I kind of have to hold back a little bit and not try and assume everyone likes running as much as I do, because I appreciate a lot of people find it a real drag. But I think, you know, for example, people that take their kids to school, are you able to walk to school even if it's just once a week? Small things like that, I feel like you get a little bit more buy-in. And I think if the patient themselves can come up with the idea, they're more likely to do it, and it sounds less, hopefully sounds less like you're telling them what to do, and it's more trying to get from them what they think that is manageable in their week, because people are stressed and it's hard to find more time to do something that feels potentially like a chore. So yeah, just trying to make it as easy as possible.
That's a fascinating statistic, and yeah, really, I think it's sort of quite motivating for myself and other professionals that actually, yeah, 12 seems definitely manageable. Maybe I'll just give up telling people to stop smoking. But the exercise, that seems something that actually in a course of a day, you know, you might see 24, 28 patients, then actually if it's something that you just sprinkle in, you know, hopefully one or two of those will benefit. So that's fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, I've also got a standing desk at work, so I see all my patients stood up. And actually, that's quite a good conversation starter, because they ask me why I'm stood up, and then I just talk about kind of how bad sitting all day is and how it's giving me aches and pains. So it's quite a natural way as people walk into the room to have that very quick 10, 20 second conversation about activity. So yeah, if you fancy a standing desk, that might be a good way to get it in there.
Interesting. Yeah, I touring around sort of various practices of locum, I often come across them, and that's always to me seemed like the issue would be how I'd see patients. But actually, even better, even easier to get them out the end, get them out the door at the end of the consultation when they're telling me about their Christmas plan. And actually to incorporate that, I think actually I have it a few times found myself people saying, you know, well, I'm very busy, I can't do this, or, you know, I've had lots of patients tell me, well, I'm going to stop you there, doctor. I walk my dog every day. We go for at least 45 minutes, and slowly trying to incorporate, you know, sort of into the conversation of progressing and saying, well, that's fantastic that you're starting there, but actually, how about in a year's time, you know, you're incorporating 5 minutes or 10 minutes of running in that walk, and trying to suggest to people that actually, you know, there are other ways of doing it. And if they come in and see that actually you are doing what you preach and, you know, haven't got a bag of Maltesers opening your desk and you're standing up, then absolutely get the message across.
Yeah, definitely.
So
we have to try and do it ourselves first, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. I won't be giving up pastry anytime soon, but I can certainly tell my patients to. So in amongst all of these things that you've been doing, the app, the coaching, obviously your GP training, you've also just finished a master's. Be fascinated to hear a little bit more about what that entailed, what led you to doing that, and what you're going to do with that qualification and research you did during it.
It was hard. That's the headline. So I did it alongside GP training, which I think I was a little bit naive, to be honest. I thought, oh well, we obviously both went to medical school. That was quite tough, and I felt like I'd be able to do this. But balancing study and work was really difficult. I think I'm someone that likes to give my full attention to one thing, so just kind of time management was a challenge. So I think if anyone's thinking about doing a master's, just maybe reflect on what you're like as a person and studying, and if it's possible. In hindsight, I'd have probably just dedicated a year to doing it full time. There's obviously financial issues with that, but studying and working is at the same time is really quite tricky. But it was fascinating. You learn, it's amazing how much you learn that you feel like you probably should have learned whilst you were doing your medical training, but we never touch on all of that stuff. Which, yeah, something for us to reflect on as GPs who are supposed to know a little bit about everything. There was a lot for me to learn, and a lot of new lingo as well. But it was great. We learned about kind of the MSK and all the injuries that are associated with sports, but also the team and event medicine, which is almost similar to general practice in that you're looking after an entire team and all their ailments, no matter what that is. We do a bit about kind of governance and doping. And then we all had our dissertation projects at the end. So I was looking at the health and safety of virtual marathon running, which is when people run a marathon on the same day as the mass event, but they're doing it basically from their own front door. And then they log their miles and they get sent the medal for the marathon. So for example, London Marathon has a virtual marathon. So on the same day as the London Marathon each year, you can choose to run it virtually, which is basically doing it by yourself, wherever you wish. So I was looking at the health and safety profile of that. It was a really good experience. You get to meet lots of people with obviously similar interests, and it was a mixed degree in terms of doctors, physios, and strength and conditioning coaches. So you get to learn a lot from other people as well, and other professions who have had very different training to ourselves.
Sounds brilliant. I'm sure there'll be lots of people listening who will definitely be having a think about whether a sports exercise medicine master's is for them. And as you say, perhaps timing it not to sit alongside work.
Yeah, definitely.
Good work there. So you mentioned doping in there. Now, as a lifelong cyclist and cycling fan, much more so than a runner, it's obviously something we're unfortunately perhaps more aware of than other sports. Now, I've been running more myself and reading more about the running world over the last couple of years, and it's something that comes up sporadically. What sort of depth of doping there might be in the professional world. Is it something you've come across much, and what are your thoughts on it? Is there any particular sort of suspect performances or things that you kind of watch out for in performances and think, actually, perhaps this isn't quite as genuine as I would hope?
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? I don't think I tend to watch performances with a skeptical eye, though maybe I should, but it is definitely... it's definitely in the running community, not to the extent that cycling is, or at least not to the extent in the media that it is with cycling. But just last month, one of the elite Kenyan marathon runners had a 10-year ban for pethidine use. There was a New Zealander this year who had been using EPO and claiming that he claimed that he thought it was the COVID injection. You know, these. These stories are often actually the saddest bit for me is not the doping, which of course is a huge problem, but it's the lies and the stories that come out afterwards, and it just all starts to unravel and look pretty damaging for the sports. I think one interesting debate, and I'm not sure if you've read much about this, is whether shoes are actually a form of doping, whether that's technological doping with all the new kind of Nike Vaporflies and Alphaflies. So there's some parts of the running community who feel that is a form of doping because it's an unfair advantage that some athletes will get these shoes and then they've got up to a 4% advantage, which is obviously huge in the elite field. And then for me, I'm almost more disheartened when it's at events like the London Marathon and other road races where you're basically giving an advantage to those that can afford £250 running shoes that last a few races compared to those who can't. And 4%, it's not something that's applicable to every single runner, but that is what the studies have demonstrated. That's a huge performance advantage. So I guess it's not drug doping, but there are rules in place to ban those shoes, which would suggest that there definitely is a performance advantage that some organizations want to make sure isn't affecting the sport and the joy of watching the sport and the joy of competition.
Well, if the running world is still injecting EPO, then they're certainly a few years behind the cycling world. That's basic 90s doping in the cycling world. Come a long way since then. So talking about the shoes, I mean, I can't sort of let you leave without getting your thoughts on how fast we can go as a species. And I know that the women's marathon record just been smashed, and we've all read or heard or listened all about the sub-2 record over the last few years and finally been broken, albeit not in a race. How much of that progress do you think is shoes? How much more can we see? You know, when are we going to see that sub-2 hour limit go in a race, and how far beyond that do you think?
I think it might happen this year, you know, not this year because we're recording in 2023, so we've only got a week left. But I wouldn't be surprised if 2024 is the year that the men beat the 2 hour record, because we're only been 35 seconds away from that, which is, I mean, it's huge, but also it's not really when you look at the advances over the last few years. So yeah, maybe I'll place my bet that'll be this year. The women's is harder because there's actually quite a big gap between the first and the second lady. So it's 2:11, I think, is the fastest time at the moment, and the second fastest lady is 2:13, which actually is quite surprising. That's quite a big time gap in my mind. So I'm going to find it more difficult to predict how the women's field is going to change over the next year. Watch this space. in terms of, sorry, you asked about whether it's shoes or not. It's difficult, isn't it? I think all of these all of these sports, we're reaching the limit and it's becoming harder and harder to get faster and make improvements. So I think a lot of it is going to rely on technology and conditions. Like Kipchoge's, the way that Kipchoge beat 2 hours was because everything around him was set up to enable him to do that. And that's not to minimize what he managed to achieve, but actually there was so much that went into that. And for people that are interested, I have a book recommendation, which is Endure by Alex Hutchinson. I'm not sure if you've read that, but it really looks at the body's limits and what we're capable of in endurance sports. And it's a really interesting read, and has a bit of a behind the scenes about the first attempt to break the sub 2 hour marathon, which actually wasn't successful. It was the kind of the second attempt in 2019 that led to Kipchoge doing that. So definitely a book recommendation there for anyone that's more interested.
I'll add it to my Christmas list, and I enjoyed him very much on your podcast as well. And I was thinking just then, you're predicting next year, and I think he predicted 2075 for the 2 hour record to go a few years back. So he was wildly off. Let's see how close you are.
Maybe I'm wildly optimistic.
Perhaps. So if that's the future of running, what does the future look like for yourself? How are you going to use all of your recent masters and all of the things you've been doing over the next few years, do you think?
Oh, another tricky question. So I'm going to finish my GP training next year, which then I guess opens up a lot of doors, hopefully. I'm doing a lot of education work at the moment. And so I'm doing my master's in med ed, and I'm really hoping that I can then combine the two and teach in sports and exercise medicine, but most importantly, try and incorporate more exercise medicine and preventative medicine into medical curricula. Because I think having gone through this process over the last 5 years, and we've spoken a lot about race medicine today, but actually another big interest of mine is exercise medicine for health. So not being an athlete, but getting patients more active, for example, before surgeries, after surgeries, for general health. And I think that is going to be the key to keeping our population healthy. And I think we don't learn enough about it. We don't learn how we can support patients with that. We don't learn how we can prescribe exercise to patients with various medical problems. So if someone comes to you in the GP and they've just had a heart attack, I don't feel like we're well equipped enough at the moment to really guide them through their rehabilitation and safely prescribe them exercise. So I think that would be my main focus for the next few years, is to really try and improve the education we have to medical students and trainees about exercise medicine, so that we can hopefully maybe help fix some of the NHS's problems, and that I feel like we're constantly putting a sticking plaster on things. And it would be nice to be a bit ahead of the curve as we all get older and keep us older and fitter, not just older and more frail.
That sounds like an excellent plan. Pretty lofty, try and fix the NHS along the way. I always feel a little bit bad asking that question, because I obviously have almost no idea what I'm going to do in the next few months, let alone the next few years. So sounds like you've got a pretty well thought through plan there, and sounds very inspiring. Obviously, your huge amount of experience in training and preparing for races, you know, training and racing and winning yourself. Any particular advice for those of us who might be approaching 2024 with a marathon marathon or ultra marathon plans and how to approach training? Any tips to get us across the line safely and perhaps under our target time?
I think joining running clubs is definitely my top recommendation, and that's not just for the running. It's just so that you can meet people that have been there and done that. You can get so much training advice online, but actually it's the little things that people will tell you about, the races that went wrong, the kit that they're using, all those little things that actually can be really helpful. They might not mean that you get the best time, but it means that you can go to the race and be less stressed because you heard from this person at the running club that you need to get there at this time, and there's this many places to go to the toilet, and you need to get there an hour before, and all of these little bits that actually you get to race day and it's so stressful. And just talking to people about how that race day looks and what they've learned along the way is really important. Like, I look back at some of the races I did at the start, and just some of the things I did were so silly, And they'd definitely be things that I would tell people if I met them at my running club. So that would be number one, get the support from those people. And my second one is don't underestimate the toll that these events take on your body. And again, that's me learning from my own mistakes. It's all the injuries I've had have come after an event. So I've trained and had no issues. I've raced and had no issues. But then I've gone back to track a week later or 2 weeks later, and really injured myself and caused quite a few problems. And it's because I haven't allowed myself to recover and rest and appreciate what my body's just done. So I think the training and the racing is important, but actually the recovery is almost the most important bit, because if you want to have longevity in your running career and running journey, then you need to allow yourself to recover and have time off, and don't rush back to track like I always seem to do.
Lots of time post-race for pastries is what I'm hearing there.
Yeah, basically.
Excellent. So you've obviously enjoyed various different avenues in the sports and exercise world. What kind of opportunities are there for people earlier on in their career, or those perhaps later on who are wanting to perhaps get more experience or transition into the area?
So I think volunteering at the big races is really helpful. It gives you a good flavour, and you can very quickly decide if it's for you or not, and it's not for everyone, and that's fine. I think my only piece of advice for that was just be cautious where you decide to do that. So I've always stuck with the larger events like London and Brighton, because you know that their medical structure is really secure and that you're well supported, and you're not going to be put in a position where you're doing things above your competency level. So I would just be slightly cautious about these smaller events. They might offer you money and they might pay you, but actually, are you suddenly the most senior person at an event, which is always fine until it's not. So a lot of the things I've done have been voluntary, but I've done that knowing that I'm still a trainee. I'm definitely no expert, and I want to do it in a safe environment to kind of learn and get better. So that would be my top tip. And then try and go to conferences, probably. So the BASM conference is an annual conference. That's the British Association of Sport and Exercise Medicine. And it's a little bit on the pricey side, but it's a really good way to go to a load of talks, get a flavour for different aspects of sport and exercise medicine, because there's different avenues. There's the race medicine, there's the exercise medicine, there's the team medicine. And there's lots and lots of coffee breaks, which initially I was wondering, why have I come to a conference and it's all coffee breaks? But that is your chance to network and to meet people and say, oh, can I come to your clinic? And I've done that a lot as well. So just talking to people, explaining what your interests are, and going in and sitting on clinics again to get a flavour and see if it actually is for you. So I think they're probably my top tips. And there's lots of free things out there as well, webinars. I try and share as many as I can, because again, it can be quite tough otherwise. A lot of these things do cost a lot of money, and especially if you're just dipping your toe in to see if you enjoy it, maybe the free things are a better thing to start with.
Some excellent ideas there. I think a lot of people will benefit from that, and be excellent to have some opportunities to kind of, as you say, dip your toes in and see if it's something that might interest you and something you want to pursue in the future. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been really fascinating today and hearing all about racing and running from the coach and from the research and from the doctor's point of view, rather than being the one out there kind of slogging through the miles and struggling. How can people get in touch with you, if possible, or how can they listen to your podcast?
So my website is marathonmedic.com, and there's an email form there. I'm on Instagram at marathonmedic, and I try and share lots of free webinars that I mentioned. I'll share information about the Race Ready app as it's launched, and also the London Marathon Medicine Conference I'll share as well, which is a free conference just before the London Marathon. So probably best to find me there, and then hopefully I can point you in directions of all these other interesting things that are going on.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Have a lovely Christmas and a good start to 2024.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.